Please be seated. Good morning. Delighted to welcome you all to our first March oral argument. And we have with us today students from La Follette High School, if they would stand, please. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they accept, then they're given materials about a case. They come to a court, and at noon they meet with a justice assigned that day to meet with the students. The discussion is about the procedures of the court in taking a case and in deciding the case. We do not discuss with the students the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is welcome to join the La Follette High School students, and they will be joined by three other high schools at noon. And they will meet with me. I'm the justice assigned today to meet with the students. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Would you raise your hand? Good, we got one. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. For on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is an empty chair. Usually seated in the chair is Justice Patrick Crooks. He will not be participating in this case. To the left of the empty chair is Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the first case, which is 088P2231CR, State versus Michael Hess. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill, appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, the petitioner in this case. The state is asking that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case that held that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule did not allow the admission of evidence that was obtained as a result of an arrest made pursuant to an invalid arrest warrant that was issued by the circuit court without any involvement from law enforcement. The Court of Appeals held that the evidence that was obtained as a result of the arrest needed to be suppressed to preserve judicial integrity. State is asking this court to reverse this decision because it is contrary to both this court's and the United States Supreme Court's decisions explaining the parameters of the exclusionary rule and the good faith exception to it. The state is asking that this court instead conclude that under the facts of this case, the circuit court properly concluded that the evidence obtained as a result of the arrest was admissible pursuant to the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. The facts of the case are fairly straightforward. The defendant was out on bond pending sentencing for a drunk driving offense. One condition of that bond was that he not consume alcohol. The circuit court ordered a pre-sentence investigation report so it could complete its sentencing. The defendant left the author of the PSI's office before the interview was completed and rebuffed her later attempts to reschedule the meeting, and the PSI writer then wrote to the judge and asked him to order that Hess be taken into custody so she could complete the PSI.
Counsel, there never was an order by the court that he show up for the pre-sentence investigation, right?
That is correct.
And everyone agrees, I think, there's no basis in the law for a warrant to issue, right?
That's correct.
So I'm just going to be honest with you from the outset. I have a hard time with this one. I have a hard time saying that when it's not like there's a defect in an affidavit or a tape recorder malfunction or something happened that's outside of anyone's control, there's really no authority to do what the judge did here from the outset. I'm not saying the judge meant to do anything wrong. I don't think he did. I don't think the PSI agent meant to do anything wrong. And I don't think law enforcement did anything wrong by executing the warrant. But when from the get-go, there's zero legal authority for this, how are you going to get me over that hurdle? Because to me, that's a pretty big one.
The question in this case, I don't think is, it's this case I think is first distinguishable from cases where that the Court of Appeals relied upon where there was no authority. I think the Court of Appeals is incorrect when they said there was no authority whatsoever in this case.
Okay, then help me with that. Show me where the authority is for the judge without a court order that the person show up, without a warrant being able to issue, without a bench warrant type thing, without a civil warrant, without a criminal warrant, tell me where the judge gets the authority to say, you can go arrest this person.
He doesn't have the authority under the facts of this case. The judge does, though, have the general authority to issue warrants.
And I think for sure.
That's a big and a very important distinction in this case. When we're talking about someone who doesn't have the authority, in a lot of the older cases, it's a court commissioner or a justice of the peace who wasn't authorized to issue a search warrant. That's just, void as a matter of law. But here, what we have is a judge who is generally authorized to issue warrants. And the question becomes, when the court looks at the facts of the case, the circuit court looks at the facts of the case and thinks it has the authority to do this, but even though it doesn't, based on the facts of the case, what is the remedy here? And the state's position is that the remedy is that you wouldn't suppress evidence because of the good faith reliance of the law enforcement officer based on the law enforcement
officer. But the good faith cases usually go to a law enforcement officer having something to do with the warrant issuing and then acting in good faith based upon that. It's not usually the judge in good faith issued a warrant that the judge had no business issuing.
Right, and I'm not claiming
that's a new good faith exception.
Right. Well, I don't think it's that the judge acted in good faith. It's that the law enforcement officer relied on the warrant that he received, that he looked at it, and I don't think there's any reason for the sheriff's deputy to question whether this warrant was valid. And under both statutory and case law, the deputy had the obligation to execute this warrant.
And I don't disagree with you. I don't think the law enforcement officer did anything wrong here. The law enforcement officer can't say, gee, judge, I'm not going to act on a warrant you issued. But the crux of it for me is when you've got something that has no validity in the law to begin with, and then someone, and I'm not saying anybody meant to do anything wrong here or acted with an evil intent or meant to undercut the law, but the fact is this warrant has zero validity legally, and then you have law enforcement acting on something that has zero validity legally, and somehow we're trying to sort of backdoor that the warrant's okay then, or that the evidence is okay, or the arrest is okay, because everybody here nobody really meant to do anything wrong, right?
I wouldn't say it's quite what I'm saying, but I think that...
pretty close. I
understand your concerns, I think that that analysis of taken to, I guess, its logical conclusion would mean the good faith exception doesn't apply.
Would mean what? Say that louder.
That argument is taken to its logical conclusion. There wouldn't be a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. A judge who issues, say, a search warrant without probable cause, as required by the Constitution, as required by Wisconsin statutes, is taking an action he or she is not authorized to undertake. But that is precisely the situation where the good faith exception can apply. I think when you look at sort of the reasonableness analysis, and I think the state's position in this case is that really the question shouldn't be necessarily whether the judge had no authority to do this. That's obviously not disputed, but the question is whether the officer in attempting to in executing this warrant reasonably believed that this was a valid warrant and could execute it.
What if
a court commissioner issued it, but it was a court commissioner that didn't have very many powers. You know, we have different levels of court commissioner. And that the court commissioner was a court commissioner that was more of an what we used to call an honorary court commissioner, with just a few kind of appointed by the judge, but really didn't do too much other than maybe needed two or three times a year for mental health commitments. No authority. Is that a problem?
To issue whatever, like an arrest warrant or a search warrant. I think that the cases, certainly in Wisconsin, that precede this court's adoption of the good faith exception would say that suppression is required in those cases.
Suppression is required.
Because it is void, because the person who issued it basically, I mean, I wouldn't say not a judge, but he just had no statutory authority whatsoever to do that.
And so you're in both this fact situation and the fact situation I gave to you, the warrant would be, as we say in the law, void ab initio. It's void from the beginning.
Yes.
Your distinction sounds to me that you're making is, well, look, a judge, even though it's void from the beginning, a judge has the authority to issue it, to issue other warrants, or to issue warrants generally.
Yes.
And that you're kind of resting your argument on whether, not focusing on something being void from the beginning, no authority, but rather in other circumstances would the person who signed it have authority to issue some kind of warrants. Is that the focus of your argument?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask you to try to speculate what was in the circuit judge's mind when he issued that civil, that bench warrant civil?
And I do have to speculate because there is, I don't think, anything in the record that gives any indication the judge who decided the suppression motion was not the same judge who issued the warrant. If I had to speculate, I would think that the judge thought that he had the authority to order the defendant to meet with the PSI writer as just a general principle of him having ordered a PSI and requiring the defendant to meet with the author and complete the interview.
Is that a civil bench warrant? Is that contempt or criminal? I mean, what is the box in which you think the court was thinking?
I think the court, if I had to speculate, I think the court was thinking along the lines of contempt, even though there was not an order in place for requiring that the defendant meet with the PSI author. But that there, if I had to guess, the judge was thinking, I've ordered this PSI, I have the authority to issue a writ or a warrant to carry out, to further the purposes of that order that I've already entered.
Now, the judge issued an order.
Yes.
The order required the preparation of a pre-sentence investigation. The defendant was not cooperating. He did not appear, at least a second time. He took the questionnaire that he started to fill out. Took it with him, didn't he?
I believe so, yes.
So there was a document that... So he was not cooperating. He was resisting.
Yes.
An order.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't appear, and he didn't provide documentation that he should have. So, and this is on a form that references the contempt statute.
The civil arrest warrant?
Pardon?
The civil arrest warrant references the contempt.
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Are there any circumstances under which the judge could have achieved what he appears to have wanted to achieve?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that upon receiving the letter from the PSI author, he could have set a court date, brought the defendant back to court, and ordered him to go meet with the PSI author and complete the form. I don't know if what extent the judge could have required him, how much he could have required him to say. The judge, I don't think, could have told the defendant, you have to incriminate yourself and admit to what you did. But certainly when you a person completes a PSI, there's all sorts of background information that the author tries to get about their family history, various things like that. And I think the judge could have ordered him to complete that form or give those answers to the PSI author. And if the defendant had refused to do that, then I think a contempt order or a bench warrant for failing to comply with the condition of the bond would have been appropriate.
Now, the judge had other options.
Yes.
Okay. I think the state's position is that unfortunately he didn't follow any lawful course in triggering sending the officer to that home.
Yes.
And I get the sense that the state is trying to argue that because the police officer was acting in total good faith on the basis of this warrant, that somehow that overcomes all of the errors by the court. Or you phrase it.
It doesn't, I wouldn't say it overcomes the errors of the court. What the court here did was order an arrest of the defendant to be taken into custody to complete this PSI. That was the court's goal. That arrest was illegal. If the defendant was brought into court the next morning after he was picked up, there had been no evidence seized from his bail jumping, the court should have let him go. The state doesn't dispute that that was what should have happened. But what happened here was the court was not trying to seek evidence of criminal activity in issuing this warrant. Instead, the court was trying to just order that the defendant be brought into court so he could, you know, explain himself, basically. And it's the state's position. If the court had been, you know, actively engaged in trying to obtain this evidence, I think we'd have a very different situation here. But what happened is the officer who executed the warrant just happened to, you know, discover that the defendant, when he arrested him, was drinking. And it's the good faith in executing that warrant that makes the evidence admissible.
Could I ask two questions? Is it absolutely clear that this defendant was not on probation at the time the officer went to the house?
I'm sorry?
Is it absolutely clear that the defendant was not on probation?
Oh, I don't think the record reflects that whether he was on probation or not. He was out on bond pending sentencing.
Oh, that's true. But I mean, this is a sixth offense, isn't it?
Yes. I don't know if he was still, on probation or extended supervision or something from a previous offense.
Go ahead.
Our Eason case is a search warrant case. This is an arrest warrant case. Eason, relying on Leon, brought the good faith exception here. And Eason says, we further hold that in order for a good faith exception to apply, the burden is on the state to show two things. Number one, that the process used in obtaining the search warrant included a significant investigation. And number two, a review by either a police officer trained and knowledgeable in the requirements of probable cause and reasonable suspicion, or a knowledgeable government attorney. Now, that's like trying to put a square peg into a round hole, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So Eason says that in order for good faith exception to apply, the state has to prove these two things. You're not able to prove these two things in the fact situation here, are you?
No, I'm not.
So why should the good faith exception apply? Why should we be extending the good faith exception to arrest warrants from the search warrant stuff that we've previously recognized? You know, maybe no probable cause or some other defect in an otherwise okay warrant.
I don't think that there's a reason not to extend the good faith exception to the arrest warrant context. I mean, it's a warrant's a warrant, but why should those exceptions or the easing requirements not apply to arrest warrants? Is that what you're asking? Or
no, I think those two things just don't fit. I mean, they don't make any sense in order for the good faith exception to apply, the state has to show A, the process used in obtaining the search warrant included a significant investigation. I mean, that's not this fact.
No.
Work and number two, that the review was by either a police officer trained and knowledgeable in the requirements of probable cause and reasonable suspicion or a knowledgeable government attorney. That doesn't seem to apply here.
Yes.
So what if you want to extend good faith exception to search warrants, since our current law doesn't seem to apply, what would you require the state to show then?
Well, I think it depends on the facts of the case, and I think what's at issue here is really the reasonable reliance of the person who executes the warrant.
So if you know, 2 years or 5 years down the road, I'm looking back at the Hess case, and then I say the Hess case extended the good faith exception to search warrants, and we hold that in order for a good faith exception to apply to, arrest warrants, I misspoke. The burden is on the state to show, number one, what?
The executing officer or officers or law enforcement overall could be charged with knowing that the warrant that they were executing was unconstitutional.
Isn't that circuitous? In order for the good faith exception to apply, you have to show that there was good faith?
No. I think you can look at the warrant itself, for example, an arrest warrant that a regular arrest warrant that has a criminal complaint attached to it. If there's no complaint attached to it, I think it's not valid under the statute, and I don't know that a police officer would be, assuming they knew that there was no complaint attached to it. Police officers don't need the warrant to often arrest people, but if they knew that there was no complaint attached to the warrant, that I don't think would be good faith, because I think they would know, they'd have reason to question the validity of the order they are executing. I think that's, you look at whether the officer knew, or a reasonably well-trained officer in the law would know that the process they're executing was invalid.
I have a couple of questions. I'm looking at the case number in the trial court, maybe this is our case number, 2005 CF00356. That's the one that's on this bench warrant, Sybil. What does CF stand for?
Criminal felony.
Pardon me?
Excuse me. It's a criminal felony.
Yeah, with a civil bench warrant. Shouldn't that cause some issue in the person who is executing it? I mean, that's what I thought it stood for, frankly, CF. What else could it stand for? But wouldn't an officer say, hey, we got a civil bench warrant in a criminal case?
I think it could definitely give a reasonable officer pause, but then again, would an officer just assume that the judge made a mistake as to the form of the warrant?
The question is, would a reasonable police officer assume the judge knew what he or she was doing?
Right, and I think that's absolutely true in this case.
And so then the question is, that are all errors of the judge then excused, because the officer has to presume that the magistrate knew what was happening, although under both good faith and Eason, they're required to give it a second look and require it. Now, my second question is, this State of Wisconsin Department of Corrections, the parole probation agent asked, and I'm looking at your brief at Appendix 128-129,
She asked the court, she says, it is respectfully requested that Mr. Hess be placed in custody, which would allow the pre-sentence investigation to be completed. Should the court concur with this request, please notify our office of such. Finally, please be advised that this agent remains confident of the ability to remain impartial despite his behavior, with a carbon copy to the DA's office and to James Martin, attorney. Who's James Martin?
He's Mr. Hess's attorney on the, I believe, on the drunk driving case.
Okay. So, as a result of that, maybe Eason has to be squeezed because it's really not covering this kind of case. But here, shouldn't the DA's office have known something was the matter? Shouldn't Mr. Martin have known something was the matter? This civil warrant, the bench warrant, which everybody now agrees is not valid?
In respect to when it was issued and then executed, I don't know that the parties were aware, or that the parties were aware that the warrant was ever issued or executed. I don't see that.
But
they got upset. The court maybe is thinking about it.
Right. Well, who asked for this? Whose agent is the probation and parole agent? Is it a law enforcement agent?
She's an officer of the court.
She's employed by the Department of Corrections.
Yes. In that capacity.
And your briefs say she's an officer of the court, but is she when she asks for taking somebody in custody?
Yes, I believe she still is. I don't see it as really any different than if there is a court order in place and the judge that the judge gets word that the defendant's violated in issuing a contempt order. She's asking the judge in her capacity as a judicial employee to help have the judge help her comply with what she's been ordered to do by the court. I don't think she's acting as a law enforcement officer in this circumstance.
In conducting a pre-sentence investigation report, do you always have to interview the defendant? I mean, sometimes they don't want to talk to you, and you get a PSI that has, you know, it's void of certain information, but you go on what you have. And if you look at the statute, it doesn't necessarily require the defendant to be contacted. They have the right to get a copy of it. If they're self-represented, then they can look at it in court and they have to hand it back in. If they have a lawyer, the lawyer has a chance to look at it. The PSI writer must contact the victim and has to do certain things under the statute, but it doesn't say in the statute that the defendant has to be contacted or interviewed, even though I recognize that's typically done. And it's a better report if you have information from their perspective too, but
yes, that's correct. The statute doesn't require that the defendant's position be included, and the defendant doesn't have to cooperate as a matter of law with the PSI writer. That's correct.
Okay, I'm just clarifying my recollection. Thanks.
Counsel, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney George Talchik, representing Michael R. Hess.
Thank you. May it please the court. This is a case where the circuit court was a responsible party, in fact, the instigator of a violation of my client's constitutional rights. And that's why judicial integrity is at issue here. According to this court in Conrad v. State, the exclusionary rule serves two purposes. First, to deter unconstitutional police conduct, and second, to ensure integrity in the judicial process by not having the process approve and be party to constitutional violations or police misconduct. The Court of Appeals decision below focuses on judicial integrity, saying that this is not the kind of case that implicates the good faith exception established under Leon and in this state under Eason. But I'd like to start off by discussing the good faith exception and explain why, even under its own terms, it would not apply to the search and seizure in this case. Leon describes four circumstances under which the good faith exception would not apply. One circumstance occurs when a police officer would not have objective good faith in relying on a warrant because a warrant is so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render belief in its existence unreasonable. Under this circumstance, the good faith exception will not apply when a well-trained police officer should have known the warrant was insufficient despite the judge's signature. In this case, there was no police officer involved at the warrant stage. The circuit court issued the warrant based on a request from the DLC agent to sign the right to PSI. The gist of her request was that she wanted my client placed in custody to get him to cooperate with the PSI. Now, if this request had been made by a police officer, it would have clearly failed to qualify for good faith under Leon. And I think this is one reason that indicates why the good faith exception was designed for police investigations. The facts of this case don't fit within the framework of the exception. Another reason is that this court, in adopting the good faith exception in Eason, saw fit to add the two law, the two law enforcement specific requirements. A third reason is that Leon would not apply good faith when the judge or magistrate who issues the warrant wholly abandons the judicial role. And here we have a situation where the DLC agent was serving as an arm of the court for the purpose of writing the PSI. The circuit court issued the warrant on its own initiative, essentially rubber stamping the request of the PSI writer to have my client placed in custody.
So where does that get you?
Oh, excuse me?
Where does it get you that the court issued it on its own initiative? It didn't quite issue on its
own
initiative.
Well, actually, I should correct myself.
There was statements by this probation parole officer.
Right. That, I probably should correct myself on that. It was at the initiative of the DLC agent assigned the right, the PSI, and the court, in my view, rubber-stamped that request.
Counselor, I want to talk to you about something that wasn't talked about much in your briefs. I want to talk about the validity of the arrest, or lack thereof. And I want to look at it in our discussion a little bit at two different times. The first time I'd like you to look at it is the moment when the officer arrested Mr. Hess. The second time I'd like you to look at it is when Mr. Hess was brought into court before a magistrate based on the arrest. And I think earlier you said that, I think opposing counsel actually said that bringing him in before a magistrate, he'd have to be let go at that point. But at the point when the arrest was actually made, when the officer arrested him, was the arrest invalid at that point?
Well, if the warrant was void ab initio.
Well, that's a different question. I want you to focus on whether the arrest was not valid, because we have cases where a police officer either pulls up on his screen in the squad car and he sees there's an outstanding warrant and that's incorrect information, and he goes ahead and arrests someone and you find out there's no warrant at all. But in fact, the arrest is held to be valid. So I want you to discuss with me whether this arrest was valid at the moment the officer arrested Mr. Hess. That's what's kind of bugging me.
Well, it was a valid arrest, I believe, because the officer did what he had to do. But the question here is whether the good faith warrant or the good faith exception should apply to that arrest warrant. And in the kinds of cases that you are referring to, Arizona v. Evans is one of them, is involved a clerical error. There was no possibility of deterrence involving either deterrence of either a law enforcement or the court when the error results from a clerical mistake. The other thing is that there was no, and more importantly, I think, there was no error either by the police or by the court in a case involving a clerical error such as Arizona v. Evans. Here we have a case where the judge made a critical error in issuing this warrant.
But usually when we suppress evidence, we suppress it because either the arrest wasn't valid or the stop was not based on reasonable suspicion if you've got some officer pulling over a car. Here, if the arrest was valid,
Once the arrest is valid and he told of Mr. Hess, that's when he learns of the alcohol on his breath. So I'm very concerned about how we deal with this case in reliance on cases where there was a simple clerical error and the arrest was valid at the moment, but later on didn't hold up when the man was brought before the woman was brought before a magistrate. It seems to me like we're not considering whether you don't have here a break in the chain of misconduct that you're arguing to us ought to support suppression. Because if the arrest is valid at the moment of the arrest, that's the moment when the evidence is obtained that you want to suppress. And that's what's bothering me, frankly.
Well, maybe I should back up on that and argue that the arrest was invalid because, but then, as I said earlier, on the basis that the warrant itself was invalid, the ab initio principle, which I don't think you approved of when I first mentioned that possibility.
Yeah.
I
guess I'm just bothered by whether there's a break in the chain of wrongdoing once you have a valid arrest, or whether that shouldn't matter to my analysis. That's kind of what I'm stuck on.
We have wrongdoing here, and I guess the decision is going to apply, going to be about what's the remedy going to be for that error.
I'm confused. Isn't this whole case about whether this initial arrest was valid?
Yes.
Deputy Sheriff goes out and takes Mr. Hess into custody, right?
That's right.
I thought your argument is that initial taking him into custody was invalid because the deputy sheriff was acting on an invalid warrant.
That's correct, yes.
Is that your argument?
Yes.
All right.
I was referring to the good faith exception because that wasn't the gist of the Court of Appeals decision below, but I was referring to the good faith exception to open up here because I thought that, for one thing, Leon outlines four circumstances under which the good faith exception won't apply, and I don't think that this would apply under some of those circumstances. It'd be another avenue for this court to consider in affirming the Court of Appeals in this case.
Counsel, is there anything in the record to indicate what the timing is? Because I'm just thinking from a practical perspective. The defendant agrees to be taken into custody. He didn't fight it, right?
Right.
And he's taken into custody, and is it contemporaneous with being taken into custody? Is it after being taken into custody? They smell alcohol in him. To me, that's not going to be 3 hours later. It's probably going to be as they're putting the cuffs on them, as they're getting them in the car, they smell the alcohol. Is there really a separation at all between the arrest and the smelling of alcohol, which is the basis?
Not significantly so. They went to his door. He came out, and the deputy went to his door. My client came out. He was taken into custody, put in the police car. I think at that time when he was placed in the police car, the deputy noticed the odor of alcohol.
When they were both in the car, or as he was?
I believe so.
Do you know?
Right around that time. I don't think it was right at the doorstep. I think it was however few minutes after that by the police car or in the police car.
Counsel, I think
he was in custody at that time, obviously.
Counsel, I think one of the valuable things about this discussion is it's sort of highlighting the duality of the tracks upon which we need to consider this case. We have the exclusionary rule and we have the good faith exception. And you began your presentation by talking about the good faith exception. I'd like to talk about the exclusionary rule because it does seem to me that they are of a piece in this particular case. Whether the officer in good faith relied upon a warrant depends, at least we're hearing the argument from both parties, as to whether the warrant was valid from the beginning. If it wasn't valid from the beginning, says the state, the officer still would have had good faith because it looked like a warrant and it looked like lawful authority to perform the arrest. The exclusionary rule, having been a judicially created remedy to curb the excesses of law enforcement, that seems to have been the genesis of the exclusionary rule. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would.
And it has been applied in our state to certain instances involving judicial officers, such as your opposing counsel made reference to court commissioners, or there's one going back a while, justice of the peace, who lacked authority per se to issue any kind of warrant. And so the exclusionary rule was applied there to say because of the lack of per se authority, there was no valid warrant. I wonder, though, in an instance where there's no doubt that this circuit court judge had the authority to issue a valid warrant and to issue a lawful warrant upon consideration of the facts, is there a similar fact pattern? Is there anything in the record to indicate that in this state there is a similar need to expand the exclusionary rule to mistaken? I don't think there's any claim of bad faith or bad intent here on the part of the circuit court judge. So we can, I think, properly term it mistaken issuance of a warrant. Is there any similar need, according to the record, for application of the exclusionary rule to any kind of instance of serial mistaken issuance of warrants by circuit court judges in this state?
Well, I'm not sure I totally agree with that characterization. Here we have a situation where the...
I didn't expect you to agree with it. but we do remember, though, that, and I'll let you answer, but we do keep in mind the fact that the exclusionary rule is provided as created to curb the excesses of law enforcement didn't occur in the context of one overstepping of bounds by law enforcement. There are dozens of cases, and the United States Supreme Court at first fired a shot over the bow by saying we're not going to adopt the exclusionary rule. We do, however, send the message to law enforcement to get a warrant. But then it was several years later where the exclusionary rule was adopted because of the court's frustration with what it viewed as police misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if there's a similar pattern here that needs to be addressed.
Well, I think you're suggesting that the exclusionary rule should apply only to instances of police misconduct. I think that in the bigger picture, the integrity of the system as a whole matters, and the police are but one actor in the criminal justice system. And I guess under the state's view of the good faith exception, in this case, there does not appear to be any need to be concerned about the role of non-police actors, even though these actors, the prosecutors and the judiciary, also have a role in upholding our constitutional rights. And I think it was undisputed here that my client was deprived of his rights due to the circuit court's initiation or rubber stamping of this unlawful warrant.
Sure, I understand that from your briefs. I understand that from your argument. But that sort of glosses over the fact that the exclusionary rule wasn't announced in response to one instance of police misconduct. It was created as a result of total judicial frustration with a series of misconduct, of instances of misconduct by law enforcement. And it wasn't the first remedy that the court came out with. In fact, as I say, they expressly declined to adopt it at first, thinking that a stern warning from the bench would be enough to curb the excesses. But here, I'm unclear from the record as to a similar series or serial nature of judicial mistakenly issued arrest warrants.
Well, we have a string of some cases in Wisconsin here that were cited in my brief where court commissioners and judges had issued warrants improperly. The police did.
Well, they issued them improperly because they per se lacked the authority to issue them.
Right. Now, the good faith exception, though, foresees a close case of probable cause and a judicial error there, not the lack of authority to issue the warrant in the first place. I think in a probable cause case, the judge is authorized by statute to make a probable cause determination. In this case, the court lacked statutory authority to even apply discretion to make a decision to issue such a warrant in the first place.
So I'm assuming the answer to my question is no, there's nothing in the record to indicate some kind of serial issuance of mistaken warrants by circuit court judges.
Well, I'm not aware. I'm not aware that other judges have made this kind of mistake before.
You think there never has been a mistake in the issuance of a warrant?
I'm sorry, but of course, not this kind. I don't think there's a serial error in ordering defendant's arrest for failure.
Everybody makes mistakes, but we hope they're not extensive and repeated. I thought there were cases that said in Wisconsin that if the magistrate lacked authority to issue that particular warrant, that the evidence would be suppressed. Now, at least one of those cases, as I remember it, but I'm trying to find it, was a 1927 Wisconsin case. And I sort of discounted that because it was pre-Leon. But then, and I'm not sure if it was that the judge or the magistrate didn't have authority to issue this warrant or didn't have any authority to issue any warrants. Then there was a 1985 case that cited, and I read, which I'm now trying to find, that said that when there wasn't authority to issue the warrant, it wasn't any good. And that was subsequent to Leon, but before we adopted a good faith clause. So I guess what I'm really asking you is, what authority do you have to say that when a magistrate when a magistrate issues a warrant without authority to issue that particular warrant, it's no good? What's your authority for that? No good meaning you suppress the evidence.
Well, there's a case cited in my brief that arrest warrants can only be issued pursuant to statutory authority. And that was a very old case.
Is that the 1927 case that I'm talking about?
I think so.
Okay.
I'm looking for it here. I can't find it.
Involving the justice of the peace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's 1927.
Yeah. Okay.
There were three other cases, too, I cited in my brief.
Remind us what they are and tell us the facts.
State v. Kriegbaum,
yes.
State v. Rawlin, and State v. Loney.
All right. And what do they stand for?
I think those cases established that the exclusionary rule applied to judicial error, and that whereas, on the other hand, judicial error of the type envisioned by the good faith exception pertains to probable cause for an arrest or search warrant in a close case. And the cases that I cited relate to the validity of the warrant in the first place. In Guawin, the warrant was issued by a court commissioner without statutory authority to issue the warrant. There was no claim in that case that the police failed to act in good faith, and suppression was the remedy anyway.
Could I ask, did the officer who executed the warrant do anything wrong?
No, I don't believe. I won't.
he didn't do anything wrong in this case. He had a warrant. He executed it. He had no choice.
Okay, so there's nothing with respect to this officer that we're hoping to deter if we suppress the evidence.
Well, the only thing that I could think of came up for the first time today. If the officer had a role in passing on the warrant by not noting that it was a civil warrant issued with a CF case number, that came up for the first time today. If that makes a difference, I'll go with that.
Isn't the real issue here, because I liked your first answer better, isn't the real issue here the extent to which the exclusionary rule applies to errors made by the judiciary? It would seem to me if it was misconduct by the judiciary, that's a little hard to look away from. But isn't the issue here the extent of the exclusionary rule to judicial errors?
Yes, I would agree with that. Was there misconduct here, though? This judge in Walworth County wanted my client, for whatever reason, to comply with a PSI writer. Now, there's no record really established on that. We don't know. The judge never made a record as to what was going through his head when he decided to issue this warrant. Was he upset with my client for not cooperating? We don't know that. But the only record we have is that he issued the warrant, and I think it probably is most safe to assume that it was just an error, you know.
What public policy is served by suppressing the evidence here?
Well, I think that the main public policy being served is to maintain public confidence in the legal system as a whole, and the judiciary in particular. Remember now that the judiciary is a state actor, and it's looked upon, I think, by the public as you know, it should have some level of integrity that comes with consequences for misconduct.
Well, this is a case of a six-time drunk driver who is released on bail, who's told that as a condition of release, you cannot drink. And yet he was drinking a lot. And the state wanted to prosecute him for violating the conditions of release. The issue here is whether that evidence should be suppressed so that he probably can't be prosecuted. Now, it seems to me you have to articulate a policy basis for suppressing that evidence where the public is going to say, yeah, really need to do that.
Well, we have the suppression principle, exclusionary rule, and you know the question here is whether it's going to apply to judicial error as well as police error. I just have to stand on the point that judicial integrity is an important public policy consideration, and in allowing judges to issue unlawful warrants. Remember, this is not a warrant that was just a simple error in a close case of probable cause. It was a warrant unauthorized by statute. I think in that kind of situation, the public policy concerns would demand that there be a remedy, and suppression is the remedy that we have available for this sort of error as established by past cases and constant cases from other jurisdictions as well.
So if it were a close case of probable cause, suppression then?
If a police officer had filed this request, and the judge erred on it, it would probably still be suppressed because it didn't even rise to the level of coming within the orbit, so to speak, of probable cause. It was even far beyond that.
What I'm not getting, quite honestly, is when judicial error should lead to suppression, and when that's too extreme a result. I just don't quite see the line.
In this case, when the court issues a warrant that's not statutorily authorized. Now, I'm trying to make the distinction between this situation and the kind of warrant that's issued in a probable cause. I keep saying a close probable cause case. There's a procedure there that the court is following. Okay, the judge makes a modest error. It falls short of probable cause. It still has indicia of probable cause, perhaps. And the police acted in good faith, and that's what the good faith exception is for. This kind of case is a case where the judge has transcended any kind of a statutory basis whatsoever. I think that we can hang our hats on that.
When I read your brief, I understood your argument to be, much like you're saying right now, that this case is a case that's without authority, that transcends any legal authority for the issuance of the warrant, and that all of the normal search warrant cases that deal with probable cause are a different kind. You're not arguing about that, as I understood your argument.
That's correct.
I understood your argument to be that, look, those kinds of cases are where good faith exception analysis applies. When the line is drawn, as you say, when it transcends legal authority, when there is no legal authority upon which to base an arrest warrant. Am I correct or incorrect? Is that where you're drawing the line?
Yes, that is. That's correct.
I didn't bring in, and I can't remember, in Growen, the Court of Appeals concluded that evidence seized pursuant to search warrants issued by the court commissioners who had not been authorized to issue them was suppressible. In that case, was the court commissioner authorized to issue some warrants but not others? Or don't you remember? I can look that up.
The court commissioner, that case involved a court commissioner without statutory authority to issue a search warrant, yes.
Any search warrant?
Yes.
In this case, the warrant was issued, I believe it was the 14th or 15th of February. It wasn't executed until the 7th of March, all in Walworth County. What happened? Do you have any idea what happened? Were there any contacts with the...
No idea what happened in between those dates. I imagine that my client was waiting for his next court date, and when, as we know, the judge got word of from the PSI writer and issued the warrant. And I don't know what the timetable is for deputies in Walworth County to go around executing their warrants.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
uh,
I just wanted to address briefly, there are some questions about the timing of the arrest. As I understand it, and this is based on an offer of proof that the state made at the suppression hearing as well as the deputy's testimony at the preliminary hearing, the deputy went to the house, or the defendant's parents' house, actually, to execute the warrant. It sounds like he was at the front door for a few minutes, sort of arguing with the defendant's parents about whether the defendant was home or something like that. But anyway, it was revealed that the defendant was at home. The defendant said, "I have a warrant for your arrest." Took him into custody, and it was as they were walking to the deputy's car that he smelled the alcohol on his breath. And I think the preliminary hearing testimony reveals that it was subsequent to that that the deputy called in and found out he had the no alcohol consumption requirement on his bond.
The circuit court made errors.
Yes.
What is the policy reason why evidence that resulted from those errors should not be suppressed?
Well, it's the state's position that it shouldn't be in this case. But as I understand, the Court of Appeals rationale is that the integrity of the judicial process requires that the evidence be suppressed here where the court made the error. I think it's, as opposing counsel stated, it's sort of the public's belief in the integrity of the judicial system in this instance requires suppression.
And why do you argue otherwise? What is the reason why it shouldn't be suppressed?
There are other ways of deterring and correcting circuit court errors here. The remedy of suppression is, as this court and the court of Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, has stated, is an extreme remedy where we're excluding evidence, probative evidence in this case, of a defendant's commission of a crime. And as the United States Supreme Court has stated in Evans, Arizona versus Evans, that suppressing evidence because of the errors of judges isn't likely to deter judges from making mistakes in the future. And I think the reason behind that is because judges don't want to make mistakes. Judges want to apply the law. And in this case, we had a mistake by a judge. We now have a published Court of Appeals opinion saying, you goofed up, don't do it again. We presumably will have a decision from this court saying the same thing. That's enough to prevent judges from making the same mistake in the future.
Counsel, are you finished? Counsel, you acknowledge then that this is an illegal arrest warrant. Is that correct? When I read your brief, that wasn't even raised. And it's illegal, why?
It's illegal because the court didn't have a reason to issue it.
It's illegal, I think, and according to your brief, because the court didn't have lawful authority to issue it. Is that right? It was issue it. It's your position that as long as law enforcement acts in good faith, that the illegality of a warrant is irrelevant?
No.
When is it relevant?
I'm sorry.
When is it relevant? I hear your argument to be, look, as long as law enforcement operates in good faith, that trumps everything. That trumps our case law that deals with search warrants because a difference in probable cause, that's no big deal. And this is a new one. That is, you agree, this is a whole new area now you're applying it to, arrest warrants, right?
Correct.
And regardless of the legality of the arrest warrant, regardless of whether it was issued by someone with authority or without authority, what's important is the good faith of the law enforcement.
Again, I would make the distinction between a judge who, or a judicial officer, like a court commissioner in the earlier cases, who cannot issue.
Did the judge have lawful authority to issue this whatsoever, any lawful authority whatsoever to issue this?
He could issue a warrant as a result of his being a judge, but their circumstances did not warrant it.
And the answer to my question is?
He did not have a reason to issue the warrant. He did not have authority to issue the warrant.
Counsel, I had the opportunity to ask your opposing counsel about the basis for the creation, the judicial creation of the exclusionary rule as a remedy that when it was created, the court deemed an extraordinary remedy. And it seems to me, based upon my reading of the case law, that it was in response to a series of what the court viewed as instances of police or law enforcement misconduct. Is that consistent with your reading of the case?
Yes.
I asked your opposing counsel about anything in the record that would indicate a similar serial nature of mistaken issuance of warrants by circuit court judges in this state. Is there any similar pattern in the record, reflected in the record, that was similar to what led the United States Supreme Court to adopt the exclusionary rule in the first place?
No, I don't believe there is, and I don't believe there's anything in decisions of the Court of Appeals or of this court showing that there are circuit court judges out there issuing warrants with impunity, even when they don't have any reason to do so.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, and thank you, Mr. Tauchuk, for your arguments today on yet another case involving searches and arrests and good faith. That concludes our hearing on 08-AP-2231-CR, State versus Michael Hess. The court will take a few minutes of